Coming up on Fronteras.
My personal belief that if Jesus is here today, he would vote Democrat. Like I said, some people would actually argue with me, who say that if Jesus was here, he would be Republican.
A look at what drives the swing vote of the Latino evangelical electorate and why the parties should care. And this election day, Californians will vote on whether to impose harsher prison sentences for sex traffickers.
It's a heinous crime. It's horrible what happens to the girls. It changes their lives in ways that they're very difficult to heal from.
Throwing the book at sex traffickers and why some victims' advocates fear it could have unintended consequences. First, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Democrats usually count on Latino voters, but Latino evangelicals aren't as predictable. A new Pew Forum study shows this growing group could swing to either party. From the Fronteras desk in Las Vegas, Veronica Zaragovia reports.
Services at the Spanish language chapel of this evangelical church are anything but quiet. On this mid-October night, about 60 Latinos are praising God with arms in the air before Bible study begins at the International Church Las Vegas in Español. The pastors, Katy and Sergio Ocanas, are in their 30s and lead a congregation of about 150. The church is very new. It opened just 4 years ago. Luis Lugo, director of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, has been charting the relationship between religion and politics among Latinos in the U.S. Lugo's new study is called Latinos, Religion, and Campaign 2012. The study shows that Latino evangelicals who are eligible to vote are coveted by both parties.
So in 2004, for instance, they went heavily for George W. Bush, more than 60%. They swung in 2008 and voted overwhelmingly for Obama, about 60% or so. So we know that this is a swing constituency. So getting a read on where they stand is very, very important.
That's because these voters are concentrated in battleground states. Roughly 24 million Latinos in the U.S. can vote. Of those, 16% are evangelicals who are less likely to favor Obama than Latinos as a whole. So a GOP candidate with a mix of religion, social conservatism, and an immigration reform platform could pick up more Latino evangelicals. Voters like Oralia Meraz of Las Vegas, who will vote for Mitt Romney. To me, she says, what are really important are values, those that my parents taught me as per God's word. I will guide my vote on that. Republican-leaning evangelical leaders argue that voters like Meraz feel alienated by President Barack Obama. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez is president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, an evangelical umbrella group. And he says many in his flock are turned off by Obama's support of same-sex marriage, his failure to act on immigration reform, and the large numbers of deportations that have happened over the last 4 years.
If the question is, does Mitt Romney have a strong possibility of acquiring the majority of the Latino evangelical vote in the 2012 presidential election, the answer is yes. The answer is I would be surprised if Governor Mitt Romney does not carry at least 65% of the Latino evangelical vote in the 2012 election.
But the Pew study shows these voters also have other concerns, which may keep them in the Democratic camp. Pew's Luis Lugo.
So one way to think about Latino evangelicals is to think of them as big government social conservatives. They take very strong conservative positions on the social issues, but on the role of government, they prefer a larger government providing more services on things like education and health care, which Latinos rank among the highest priority areas for them.
Like a lot of people, like Hispanic community, I'm a Democrat, but I'm a very right-wing Democrat.
Juan Carlos Orozco is an evangelical convert who became a citizen in 2005. He says he voted for Obama in the last election.
My personal belief that if Jesus is here today, he would vote Democrat.
Of course, not everyone in his church agrees.
You know, there's a kind of a torn bipartisan operation going on here. Like I said, some people would actually argue with me, would say that if Jesus was here, he would be Republican.
Most religious Latinos are Catholic, and 75% of Catholic Latinos support Obama. Still, Republicans may want to look to the future for support from this evangelical bloc. Their numbers are growing inside this country, and many more immigrants are arriving here who already identify as evangelicals. In Las Vegas, I'm Veronica Zaragovia.
And this election day, Californians will vote on Proposition 35, which, if approved, would impose harsher prison sentences for traffickers. San Diego is one of the nation's top hubs for human and sex trafficking. Prop 35 enjoys broad-based support, but Fronteras reporter Adrian Florido says there are also fears it could have unintended consequences.
Jordan is 23 and lives at a San Diego home for victims of sex trafficking. She asked we use only her first name because she's recovering from almost 6 years of forced prostitution and she's still afraid of her pimp. She remembers when things went wrong. She was looking for a job, and a friend introduced her to a man who said he could help.
So I think going with him thinking it was just, I don't know, going to be some little chores or whatever, it ended up where he was like, you know, I need you to go on the corner and you're going to be making this quota for me and you're going to do it or I'm going to hurt you. I mean, that's how he kept me in line, was making threats and beating me up and raping me, that it made where I was too scared to leave.
Stories like Jordan's are the reason behind Proposition 35 on the November ballot. The proposition would impose tougher penalties on human traffickers, those who force people into sex work or other forced labor for their own financial gain. If passed, Prop 35 would increase trafficking prison terms from 5 to 8 years to a minimum of 12 years and a maximum of life. It would increase fines for convicted traffickers from $100,000 to up to $1.5 million, money that would go to fund programs that help trafficking victims recover. It would also expand the definition of sex trafficking to include the production of child pornography, and it would require registered sex offenders to have their online activities tracked. The proposition has broad support among law enforcement officials, Democrats and Republicans, and many victims groups across the state.
It's a heinous crime. It's horrible what happens to the girls. It changes their lives in ways that they're very difficult to heal from.
Susan Muncy is the director of Generate Hope, the home where 23-year-old Jordan is recovering. She cites FBI statistics that place San Diego among the nation's top sex trafficking hubs.
I think this initiative can move us in the other direction and really put some teeth into the laws.
Prop 35's architect is a Bay Area victims advocate named Daphne Fung, and its main funder is former Facebook executive Chris Kelly. He's donated nearly $2 million to the Yes on 35 campaign. The proposition has little organized opposition, but some attorneys, advocates, and researchers say it is flawed. Stephen Munkelt is a defense attorney who testified in Sacramento.
Sometimes just punishment, just imposing penalties, isn't the most effective way to address a problem.
Amy Carpenter is a University of San Diego professor who researches human trafficking, and she agrees.
For one thing, it's based on a presumption that more arrests and stiffer penalties are going to decrease the level of trafficking. What we've found in San Diego works is a comprehensive approach where you have trained law enforcement, which Prop 35 provides for, but you also have victim services providers at the table, you have community members.
Even San Diego District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis has concerns, saying Prop 35 could actually make it harder to save victims from their pimps. The proposition would no longer allow prosecution of people forced into prostitution. But some prosecutors say that's sometimes the only way to free them from their pimps and get them help. But Brian Marvel, president of the San Diego Police Officers Union, says Prop 35 would help victims by requiring police officers to get training on how to identify them.
So this is just really on the cusp of opening it up and giving the officers the education so they can more easily identify that this is a human trafficking victim.
Jordan says the proposition would help her in one more way. She eventually wants to press charges against her pimp, but says many young women are afraid to because they fear revenge when the prison term is over.
You know, if I had reported him, he's going to know it was me.
Some Prop 35 opponents counter that if victim safety is a concern, traffickers could be prosecuted under federal law, which already provides for much longer sentences. In San Diego, I'm Adrian Florido.
There's still more fronteras coming up. In El Paso, NAFTA went from foe to friend. The city initially lost tens of thousands of jobs. 20 years later, things are getting better.
I think that there's probably more promise and opportunity here than you've ever seen in the history of the region.
Find out who's hiring in our next installment of NAFTA, 20 years later. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. In the two decades after NAFTA was signed, American manufacturing jobs took a nosedive, particularly after the year 2000. In the Southwest, that loss was most devastating to Texas border cities such as El Paso, which for 40 years had relied heavily on the garment industry. In our series, NAFTA, 20 years later, Monica Ortiz Uribe reports that these days El Paso is getting back on its feet.
In 1950, El Paso began building a reputation as America's blue jean capital.
When he says jeans, he means Wrangler.
The city marketed itself as a place where an ample Latino workforce could sew a pair of Wranglers for cheap. Some 50,000 people worked in manufacturing, half of them in apparel. But after North America opened its doors to free trade, more than half those jobs vanished. Some went to Mexico, while others went to Asia and Central America. Suddenly, El Paso had an identity crisis.
The community went into shock.
Steve Ortega is a city councilman in El Paso.
In 1998, there was a community summit that was called together by business and political leadership, and the question was, what is El Paso going to do? And at that time, the idea was, let's start to focus on our location as a positive.
So, El Paso decided to befriend its enemy. Instead of cursing the job-snatching factories across the border, the idea was to service them. That is, services like logistics, transportation, accounting, and company management. Over the last 20 years, those service sectors have matured and multiplied, helping boost the economy. Today, one out of every four new jobs in El Paso is thanks to cross-border trade.
Hi, this is Melvin from the SBT Command Center.
A perfect example is this company, Secure Origins. Its business is to monitor the transportation of goods across the U.S.-Mexico border using GPS and computer technology. The idea is to try and prevent contraband from mixing with the cargo. John Rippey is the chief of operations.
I think that there's probably more promise and opportunity here than you've ever seen in the history of the region.
Secure Origins is housed together with other emerging tech companies in an old garment factory. Rippey said the company's main goal is to move more trucks faster.
We have $80 billion in land trade, every single year coming through in this particular region. If we could increase that 10%, that is billions of dollars. Those are more jobs. That's increased quality of life.
And that's exactly what's happening all along the Texas border. A study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas released this summer shows that in the last decade, per capita income in Texas border cities has been growing faster than the national average. The study attributes two-thirds of that growth to cross-border trade. California is experiencing similar growth, while Arizona and New Mexico are just waking up to the economic opportunities of trade with Mexico. Roberto Coronado co-authored the study.
It's a good transition for the overall economy because services-related jobs typically come with higher wages, higher standards of living.
There's still a ways to go. Despite the good news, El Paso still ranks 30% below the national average for per capita income, and pockets of poverty exist all along the Texas border. But the proof of new prosperity is undeniable. El Paso opened a medical school in 2009. The city recently signed a deal to host a AAA baseball team. And yes, locals are even excited about soon getting their first IMAX theater. Meanwhile, dozens of locally owned restaurants, bars, and cafes have flourished in the hands of young entrepreneurs like Raul Gonzalez, also known as Chef Rulis. On a weekday at lunch, his place is packed.
You can come here and you'll have musicians and different types of artists sitting next to bankers and lawyers and healthcare workers.
4 years ago, Gonzalez left his banking job in Houston. Opening his own hometown restaurant has always been his dream.
People are proud of their local establishments, and we're getting people to be proud of the city.
And that's a pride that's long overdue. In El Paso, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
Across the Southwest, many people are proud of their homes and backyards, but they're getting some unexpected intruders. More and more bears are showing up in people's kitchens, garages, and flower beds. Wildlife officials in Colorado say in that state alone they had to euthanize 133 so-called problem bears last year. And in Arizona, at least a dozen bears have been euthanized and scores of sightings have many people rattled. Most are in search of food and water. From Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
A bear attacks an Arizona man in the middle of the night.
We're going to start with a bear's morning jaunt through a Southern California neighborhood.
It's happened again for the third time in 3 weeks, a bear attack northeast of the valley. Tonight we have live in-depth coverage.
Ever since people thought it was a good idea to move to wooded mountain towns, they've had run-ins with bears. But add an extended drought and wildfires to that trend, and those bear-human encounters become a bigger problem. The long drought and fires have killed off berries, acorns, and other favorite foods in parts of the Southwest. So animals have become resourceful. Andy Rogers is a habitat specialist with Arizona Game and Fish.
The grasses that they feed upon are non-existent in their normal environments. Something like a prickly pear cactus or something that you grow in your yard might look really juicy to them. And so you get an animal that maybe once had enough food outside of your yard area now comes in to chew on your ornamental flowers.
And some people think they're doing wildlife a favor by actually leaving food out for them. Shelley Shepherd's job is to educate the public for Game and Fish.
A fed bear is a dead bear. When you feed wildlife, you're changing the animal's behavior. You're changing their regular daily patterns. You are also possibly teaching an adult animal habits that they then pass on to their young.
Then the bears grow to expect the food and lose their fear of humans and risk an encounter that could end up in the bear's death. Bruce Sicko works out of the Pine Top Game and Fish Office in northeastern Arizona, where most of Arizona's bears live. Sicko says last season they received around 300 calls about nuisance bears. If it's a cub, they can trap it and take it to a zoo, but often zoos are full. Sometimes they can relocate the bear, but Sicko says often that doesn't work.
We captured a bear that was causing a problem behind the restaurant in the dumpster. Took the bear about 60 miles, let the thing go, and within 5 days, that same bear was back at the same dumpster. And we know this because of the identification tags we put in the ears.
So it was killed. Arizona Game and Fish rewrote its policy on dealing with bears in the mid-1990s. That's when a problem bear living near a southern Arizona campground was relocated several miles away. It came back and mauled a teenage girl. Today's policy is to euthanize adult males after their first human encounter because they are considered more aggressive. Females or yearlings get a second chance. Game and Fish ear tag them and drive them several miles away. If they come back, they're euthanized. The Sierra Club's Sandy Barr understands an animal has to be killed when it's clearly a threat to public safety. But she says they were here first. Bears and mountain lions may be predators, but they're part of the ecosystem, and therefore Game and Fish should do more to protect them.
We think the agency is actually overall headed in the wrong direction. Their policies are very anti-predator. I think a big concern is that they would backslide on some of these education efforts and revert back to, you know, shoot first and ask questions later.
That's the last thing we want to do. It's the last resort, is to have to put an animal down.
Even with strict policy guidelines, Shelley Shepard says Game and Fish officials try to look at each case individually and then decide what the best option is. Game and Fish can expect more bear calls in coming years, as evidence suggests more intense drought throughout the Southwest. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. The handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.